Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today we start off with the Albany Clean Air Coalition discussing Thursday night hearing down in Ravenna on weekend end of Queeman's clean air law.
Then we talk to Martha Hennessy about her upcoming prison sentence for protesting nuclear weapons as part of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7.
Then Corrine Carey discusses Troy's proposed pay-as-you-throw waste program with City Council member Anasha Cummins ahead of Thursday's public hearing on the budget.
And after that, Catherine Rafferty speaks with Tisha Graham and Esther Patterson about BirthNet, a Capital Region birth justice organization.
We finish up by hearing from a school principal in Arbor Hill about the challenges of teaching remotely during COVID. But first, headline news.
The Trump administration and the Cuomo administration are continuing their war of words about the development and provision of a vaccine against COVID-19. Cuomo claims that the federal government has not developed a plan that ensures states have the resources to provide vaccinations in communities of color. The White House responded that Cuomo has missed 17 meetings where he would have had the opportunity to raise his concerns. And that would be the governors who will determine the vaccine distribution priorities in their own states.
As local board of elections begin their very slow process of counting absentee ballots, Democrats in the state Senate are picking up the vast majority of votes and are overcoming large leads in many districts that Republicans had on election night. It now appears that the Democrats will expand their majority control of the state Senate and may even get to a two-thirds majority, which will enable them to override any veto by the governor. The Time Union reports that in the open 46th Senate district that includes part of the Capital Region, Democrat Michelle Henchy is trailing Republican Rich Amador by roughly 5,800 votes. But there are 15,000 absentee ballots that remain to be counted.
And the Times Union reports that Feed Albany, the not-for-profit organization that since the coronavirus pandemic started 8 months ago, has provided 150,000 meals for individuals who are at risk or in need. They have launched another relief effort, this one for restaurant employees. The Capital Region Restaurant Fund will provide short-term financial assistance to members of the hospitality industry.
The Gazette reports that the jail guard fired for allegedly beating a detainee at the Schenectady County Jail last week was arrested on Tuesday in connection with the assault. The victim spent a week in the hospital with serious injuries, including broken ribs and a collapsed lung.
And the Troy Record reports that the start date for high-risk winter sports such as basketball, competitive cheerleading, ice hockey, and wrestling at public schools has been moved to at least January 4th, 2021. Low and moderate risk winter sports will be permitted to begin on November 30th.
That's it for headlines.
And so on Thursday night, November 19th, the town of Queeman's will hold a public hearing on a law passed last year to prevent the Lafarge cement plant in Ravenna from burning tires. Residents worry that the law will be amended to allow tire burning. Here, Mark Dunley talks to Barbara Heinzen of the Albany County Clean Air Law.
We're talking with Barbara Heinzen, who is with the Albany County Clean Air Coalition. And this Thursday, a public hearing is scheduled at 6 p.m. By the town of Queeman's back in 2019. The town adopted a clean air law to establish clean air standards for waste burner facilities, particularly related to the Lafarge Wholesome cement plant, which wants to burn millions of tires every year at the Ravenna cement plant. So Barbara, what are the concerns that people are having, you know, with this hearing, and what do you think this hearing, you know, may be trying to accomplish?
Thank you, Mark. The history of this is that when the clean air law was passed, it was opposed by Lafarge Wholesome and also by the Port of Queens. The Port of Queens has a contract from DEC to recycle, pick up and recycle old tires from around New York State, and Lafarge wanted to burn them so they wouldn't have to pay as much for fuel. As soon as that law was passed, the campaign started to get the board out that had passed the law, and in its place, we now have a board that is dominated by men who have business links to the Port of Queens. And during the campaign, the supervisor, George McHugh, who's running for supervisor, said he would not repeal the clean air law because he knew it was popular. So instead of repealing it, he says, well, we're just going to amend it a bit here and there so that we don't have trouble in the future. And his amendments are what are coming up for the public hearing on this week on the 19th. And it's 19th of November. So that's the background.
So, you know, what are, you know, some of the concerns that, you know, residents have about, you know, the possible burning of tires at this cement plant? And why is the cement plant even in the business, possibly, of burning tires?
If you look at the Lafarge Wholesome website, they have a subsidiary called GeoCycle. And the business of GeoCycle is to take waste materials like municipal waste and old tires and convert them into fuel that they can use in their cement plants. This helps them to save on costs, and it also solves a problem for municipal and government authorities who do not know what to do with the waste that has accumulated in our societies. So it looks like a good solution in many, many, many ways. However, the research shows that burning this mixture of tires and coal and municipal waste, which Lafarge has said they may also want to do at some stage, can produce toxins that are quite seriously hazardous to human health and to the environment around them. So it saves money for the Lafarge company or anybody else who's burning waste as fuel, saves them money on fuel, but we pay a public price for it in the emissions that come out of the smokestack.
Now, up in Cohoes, of course, we have the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator, which has been in the news a lot. What a lot of people may not know about the Norlite incinerator, in fact, is pretty much a cement kiln. It basically uses burning of this hazardous waste to create aggregate from, you know, products on site. But the reality is that Norlite makes most of its money not from its aggregate business, but actually getting paid to burn waste in that that kiln. You know, is Lafarge actually going to get paid, not just reduce their fuel costs, but are they going to make any money from the burning of these materials?
That's a good question, and I'm not on the board of Lafarge, unfortunately. I doubt they would have me. But it's entirely possible that they could get paid for taking waste, which means they not only save on their fuel costs, they have an additional income stream. So again, from a business point of view, it's a good idea. But from a public health point of view, I have yet to see any research, and I have seriously looked for it, that says that this burning of tires in particular is safe. What research I have seen has come from either the cement industry or from the tire companies, who would like not to have the responsibility of taking back the tires they sell to us, so that they are then saddled with the problem they created, which to me would be the way to do it.
You know, Albany County did pass its own clean air law. How does that clean air law that was passed, you know, relate to the situation in Queens?
Yeah, we'd hope that when the George McHugh's board was elected, we hope that an Albany County clean air law could compensate for the likely weakening of a law in Queemans. And I would like to believe that's true, but there's some provisions in the Environmental Conservation Law of New York State that says a local jurisdiction like Queemans can pass a law that is more strict in its environmental standards. But when it concerns air and solid waste, it can also pass a law that is less strict. Now, I don't know how that little clause got into the Environmental Conservation Law, but that is the risk we run, that if the clean air law in Queemans is weakened, Albany County will not cover it because Queemans has the last say on what environmental standards apply in their jurisdiction.
I also have heard the possibility that it seems like Queemans is looking to really, the government is really looking to expand the waste management business in town. Is that like going to be their, I don't know, local economic anchor or something, more waste for Queemans?
I see the waste management business as being very much driven by Carver Laraway, who owns the Port of Queemans and a number of associated businesses. His port imports road salt and aggregate for road building, and it seems to be quite a successful business. He also persuaded the town board recently that they should amend the solid waste law in Queemans, which has had a prohibition on the importation of solid waste for about 20 years. And he got that law amended, so solid waste importation is still prohibited, except if it's been approved by the town board for a transfer station at a designated site. And as best I can tell, since that change in the solid waste law was approved in July, I am seeing more heavy ships come up to the Port of Queemans and with heavy loads and going back much lighter. So I think that maybe the handling of solid waste at the Port of Queemans has increased since that revised solid waste law was passed. But that's a guess on my part. I have to be honest about that.
Okay. Now, in a press conference that was held on Wednesday with the Albany Clean Air Coalition, I noticed that the League of Women Voters also participated. What's the League's role in this?
The League has been a very good supporter of both the clean air law in Albany County and also the Queemans clean air law. And they have helped us establish the sort of the what's due process. They've been very, 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 very conscientious. They also tried to hold a voter forum, a candidate forum during the election when the supporters of the clean air law were voted out. But the business interests suddenly withdrew and they didn't want to participate. So this is a board that, when it was running for office, did not get much public scrutiny. It spent an enormous amount of money to convince, you know, a very small electorate in this small town, and is now functioning as a board that pretty much represents the business interests in town and not the interests of citizens.
Talking to Barbara Heinzen, who is with the Albany County Clean Air Coalition. Barbara, if people want more information about this project or this issue, how best can they find that?
You catch me on the hop here. There is an Albany County Coalition Clean Air Coalition website, and I don't have the...
I see there's also, at least the hearing is going to be streamed at www.facebook.com.
Yes, that's right.
Queemans, NY. So we want to thank Barbara for joining us here today. And this has been Mark Dunley with the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. And we'll certainly report in the news headline on Friday as to whether or not the... Queemans Town Board is seeking to actually weaken the law, and this will be part of our ongoing coverage of the fight to win clean air for the Capital District.
And now, four peace activists were sentenced to federal prison last week for activism against a suspected nuclear weapons depot in Georgia. Carmen Trotta, Martha Hennessy, Claire Grady, and Patrick O'Neill, along with fellow activists from Plowshares, the anti-nuclear Christian pacifist movement, were charged with three felonies. Here, Mark talks with Martha.
We're talking with Martha Hennessy, who is one of the members of the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, who unfortunately just got sentenced to 10 months incarceration, as well as 3 years of supervised probation, as part of the protest that her and six others did at Kings Bay around the issue of nuclear weapons. So, Martha, maybe start off. I know you've been on this show before, and you know, Catholic worker. Actually, your grandmother, Dorothy Day, one of the founders of Catholic Workers. But can you tell us a little bit of a background? Of, you know, what was this, you know, event about? Why were you, you know, sentenced?
Well, this was a Plowshares action, we went on to Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in April of 2018 to point out that this weapon system is lethal and immoral and very illegal. And we were put on trial. We were found guilty of conspiracy, destruction of property, trespass, the usual charges, and we were not allowed any kind of a real defense, expert testimony on, you know, nuclear weapons and why we did the action. And so we were just finally sentenced this past week, and we're very excited. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons will be coming into effect in January. So this push for nuclear abolition is, I think, going quite well, you know, despite us being sentenced to prison.
You know, I think I mentioned last time we talked, I had been arrested three times when I turned 65 protesting fossil fuel plants around the issue of climate change. But the worst I got, you know, was 16 hours of community service. 10 months is, you know, a considerable amount of time. What was your feeling when you heard the sentence that was levied against you?
Well, we were told initially they were threatening us with 20 years. And then the sentencing guidelines were 18 to 24 months. So, you know, I was prepared for a 24-month sentence, but there was some good downward departure, bringing it down to 10 months. And I have already served two. You know, I guess my biggest concern is COVID in the prisons. So I am hoping for home confinement and or a halfway house rather than having to go into the federal prison system physically. But we will see. You know, we are privileged people, of course. And, you know, it could have been a lot worse. It would have been a lot worse if we were not who we are. And yeah, the judge should have concluded that nuclear weapons are horribly dangerous and not given us any time. But, you know, it's imperative that they try to use pretty significant punitive measures to deter people from protesting the nuclear bombs.
Now, has, you know, this protest and others against nuclear weapons, and you mentioned that this new international treaty against nuclear weapons just went into effect, I think, believe Honduras was the 50th country to sign on. Is there any change, you know, in, you know, the American government's, you know, position with respect to the deployment of nuclear weapons?
No, we will just keep pushing as hard as we can and as long as we can to be the nuclear bully on the planet and to keep our weapons and to upgrade them. And it's driven by profit, the corporations who are making and selling these weapons, not just the nuclear weapons. And I don't think the U.S. Is going to change its stance until it's forced to.
Now, you know, had co-defendants, and they apparently seem to have had their sentences given out at different times. But, you know, how are some of your co-defendants doing in terms of the sentences they were provided?
Steve Kelly was given 33 months, but he has already served his time. and he will be transported out to the West Coast to resolve another lesser situation charge. Patrick O'Neill did receive 14 months. Claire Grady received 12 months. Carmen Trotter received 14 months. And, you know, we're just moving forward. This is all part of what's to be expected when you take on a plowshares action against nuclear weapons. And so, yeah, the greatest trepidation is the fact that we're risking our lives with COVID.
Now, you were allowed to give a statement at your sentences. What were some of the key points that you made to the court?
That, you know, my action is faith-based, that I have petitioned my government. I've tried to address this issue in many other ways throughout my lifetime, and that I'm not at all. My intent is for nuclear abolition. I don't like to have this kind of action trivialized by labeling it a breaking and entering, when in fact it was, you know, a plea for sanity and a plea for love and to disarm the nuclear weapons.
Now, one of the points I think you made, you know, was that, you know, your belief that nuclear weapons, you know, are illegal. You know, why do you believe that? And, you know, my assumption, based on some of your prior statements, is your courts really probably didn't allow you to make some of the legal arguments you would like to advance in the case?
Yes. Well, I guess probably I would cite the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which every 5 years gets reviewed and nothing gets done. And in fact, we are now, you know, upgrading our arsenal. So there's a violation there of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And of course, the Trump administration has just kicked down the INF treaty, the arrangement with Iran to de-escalate that situation. And now the New START treaty is up for renewal. And the Nuremberg principles, the Geneva conventions, all in fact, the U.S. Army manual, they all talk about the illegality of wholesale slaughter of civilians. And having these kinds of weapons with this scale of destructiveness, it's not legal. It's a war crime. And in fact, the United States has committed war crimes with World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and we have not been held accountable. But if we were brought into the International Criminal Court, I think a case, which there is a case right now concerning our war crimes in Afghanistan, and I think that that case can be put together. If we were allowed expert testimony in the federal court, I think that there is enough evidence there all around to say that, yes, these weapons are illegal. We also cite in the Constitution Article 6, Section 2, where treaties are binding and the law of the land, and judges must pay attention to them.
So, you know, what should people, you know, listeners who are, you know, sympathetic to the issue that nuclear weapons is not good for, you know, life on the planet, what can people do at this point to try to stop, particularly America and its nuclear weapons arsenal?
I think the first thing, of course, is awareness and education, you know, really finding out and studying the issue and reading up the history of this. And we picked up right where the Nazis left off with this nuclear program. And after education, to finding ways to figure out how to engage, you know, as each person can, from where they are, everybody can do a plowshares action. You know, you can support the efforts of ICANN. Right now, there is a big effort starting with petitioning and putting pressure on Congress to be aware of the TPNW, Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and to really put the pressure on to get the United States to sign on to it. There are no nuclear weapons states signed on to it now, of course, nor some of the umbrella countries. But there is an effort in Japan right now to really walk away from supporting this U.S. nuclear hegemony.
So we've been talking with the Martha Hennessy, the Kings Bay Plowshare 7. There is a website, kingsbayplowshare7.org. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners, Martha?
Well, I think it's really important to never give up hope. The vast majority of people want nuclear abolition, and there are many, many, many people and organizations working towards this, and it's always hopeful. And our sentencing, the judge was forced to hear things that, you know, she has never heard before with some of these testimonies. So every effort matters.
And that was Martha Hennessy of the Plowshare 7, Kings Bay Plowshare 7. And every Wednesday, we have a segment focusing on peace activists here in the Capital District.
I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106, and a whole bunch of other good stations.
And all coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. So to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Next up, Troy's proposed 2021 city budget would institute a pay-as-you-throw, that's P-A-Y-T, plan for dealing with the city's solid waste disposal. Corrine Carey spoke with Troy City Council member Anasha Cummings about the plan and its rollout. The City Council hearing on the budget is Thursday, that's November 19th.
According to the Environmental Protection Agency, pay-as-you-throw programs have been adopted by cities across the country as a direct economic incentive to recycle more and generate less waste. In communities with pay-as-you-throw programs, residents are charged for the collection of municipal solid waste, ordinary household trash, based on the amount they throw away. Traditionally, we pay for waste collection through property taxes or a fixed fee, regardless of how much or how little trash we generate. Pay-as-you-throw breaks with tradition by treating trash services just like electricity, gas, and other utilities. Households pay a variable rate depending on the amount of service they use. Proponents argue that these programs are simple and fair. The less individuals throw away, the less they pay. In fact, when Troy instituted a trash fee of $164 in 2018, which then quickly went up to $180, many opponents of that fee argued that they shouldn't have to pay so much per unit if they weren't throwing so much away. It seems an even louder chorus of Troy residents are complaining that this new plan isn't fair either. I'm joined by Troy City Council member Anasha Cummings to discuss Troy's plans for putting a pay-as-you-throw program into place in the Collar City. Thank you for joining me, Anasha.
Thanks for having me. It's good to talk.
Can you describe what Troy's pay-as-you-throw program would look like? And is this a done deal?
Yes, I can certainly give you an overview. To answer your, is it a done deal? Certainly not. It seems that I am the only member of the council that's supporting it at this moment. Certainly the rest of my colleagues seem to be supportive of the concept, but are hearing the outcry of concern about it and looking to delay the program indefinitely. That being said, I believe that would throw the budget into imbalance, and I haven't seen solutions to solve that. Just a quick overview of the concept. This would allow us to reduce the annual fee such that the annual fee roughly covers the infrastructure costs to make sure there's a guy or a girl to pick up the trash each week, the trucks and the people. But then the incremental cost, the cost of actually tipping that trash into the landfill, and the cost of it's more expensive to pick up three bags than to pick up one from a given household. And so that incremental cost is shifted into a per unit fee. Under this proposed program, in the first year, the households would be paying an annual fee of $136 rather than $180, and then would pay a fee per bag of garbage they produce. So for a 13-gallon bag, the proposal is $1.25, and for a 30-gallon bag, the proposal is $2.
Is the outcry a lack of understanding? I mean, I've been watching the discussion on some of the neighborhood groups on social media, and it is blistering. And I know that you initiated a discussion on Reddit, and the responses to you were pretty harsh as well. So what's the outcry a result of? Is it a lack of understanding?
I think there's a mix of things. There are certainly some valid concerns. The question is, are those concerns outweighed by the concerns around the current program? Change is always hard. My sense is that the current program is incredibly unfair to a lot of people. There are many seniors who produce a relatively small amount of trash and yet are paying for everyone else's trash. You know, I think there are certainly questions around enforcement that there hasn't been time to adequately address. The EPA recommends when you roll out this kind of program that you do a 9-month sort of consensus building process that you engage in to make sure that the community is ready for this significant change in the way we treat our garbage and recycling. That was not done this year. We as a council found out about it literally at the beginning of October with everyone else. You know, I think that timing was unfortunate and has made it difficult to build the consensus needed around this program. I'm hopeful that it can still happen over the coming years, but as it is right now, I think we'll probably remain with the, to me, unfair system of subsidizing people's trash production.
Well, isn't that interesting? I actually thought that I was late to the game when I found out about it in early October. And the way I found out about it is that I saw a very strangely shaped PDF that the mayor's communication guy posted on social media. I saw it. I immediately reached out to see if we could bring the mayor on the program to explain it. And we were met with dead silence. We reached out to the recycling coordinator. We repeatedly asked for interviews with the mayor, and nothing. And I think what's surprising to me is, you know, the backlash for the trash fee in 2018 was intense. And city officials, even since then, that's been a thorn in their side. What's going on here? Is it just that the mayor is term limited and maybe he just doesn't care about the outcry here? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't on the council during that fight, but I do see a lot of parallels where it was released to the council at the last minute with the assumption that everyone would love this plan. It's something people have supported for a long time. People like the concept of it. And I think they just were cut flat-footed with the opposition.
Twice.
It's exactly the same pattern. And given that, you know, I think they should have predicted it. Certainly other communities that have implemented similar programs have gone through very similar challenges. There's plenty of lessons to be learned from other municipalities on the importance of consensus building in this process. So I don't know why that happened. If I were to guess, when compiling a budget, it's a tough thing to do. And I think the rest of the council is going to see if this is not passed, it's either going to result in a dramatic cut in our ability to serve residents with consistent trash pickup, or it will result in yet another significant increase. The math I've been seeing out of the comptroller's office is that without this program, the trash fee would have to go up to at least $205. That does not include any improvements to the program, and I think most residents would agree that the current program is not working particularly well. It's at its limits, and people are not getting consistent bulk pickup or consistent leaf pickup. The pay-as-you-throw system would reallocate staff and provide a lot more staff time if they're not having to pick up that 35% of trash that is diverted under a typical pay-as-you-throw program. They're able to spend much more time on recycling collection and other bulk collection. So that reshaping is important. But again, you know, if it doesn't happen this year, I think we're going to continue to see a stressed department. And I don't know, you know, it'll be interesting to see at the public forum tomorrow night what my colleagues have to say about how, you know, last night the council president said she was adamant about keeping the fee at $180. To do that, we'd have to cut staff. And, you know, I don't see a lot of staff to cut in that department. They're working as hard as can be imagined, picking up everyone's trash as it is.
Gotcha.
And if we're proposing not to lower their volume, while cutting staff. I don't understand how that works.
Let's talk about illegal dumping for a second. The consensus from those I've spoken to about this issue is that there was a disastrous failure on the part of the administration to anticipate widespread illegal dumping when free bulk pickup was eliminated last year. And as you know, the Hudson Mohawk magazine is run out of the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And we, along with lots of other folks in North Central, have had to deal with illegal dumping and then trying to convince the city that we're not dumping behind our own building. Is this just another failure to consider that this is the likely impact?
I agree that that is the biggest concern with this program, and it hasn't been adequately addressed in our discussions. They cited other municipalities that have implemented this and said that it was relatively quick. As long as enforcement was effective out the gate, those problems got under control pretty quickly. I think what's clear is that enforcement hasn't been effective under the current program. And so I agree, and I share the concern. And so I certainly understand why there's a lack of faith in the public eye with the administration's ability to fairly enforce, you know, what happens when someone dumps their unpaid for bag in your bin. Do you get fined for that? Under the program, there'd be a few warnings. There'd be a longer process before it would get to a fine. That's where this program starts to get much more complex when you look at how you figure out who's not following and who to bill.
I'm not fundamentally opposed to this issue, but Anasha, I've done the math. If my household dumps out one 30-pound bag a week, which is what it looks like you think the average pretty much is, that's $104 a year plus the $132 dollar fee. You said it was 136. I've seen numbers of 132 on the website. That's $236 a year. That's $56 more, you know, just right off the bat, $56 more a year. And it's not so much that, I mean, look, nobody wants to pay more money. It's more the, you know, let's be honest here. It is going to be more money. How can it be less?
There's a couple math errors that I made initially too. First, the proposal is that this program only runs for 3 quarters. And so the first quarter is not included. People won't be buying bags for that quarter. And so there are only 39 weeks, which means the 9-month cost to buy one 30-gallon bag per week is $78 for the average household. You then add in the savings in terms of the reduction of the fee. That's about $70. And again, I'm reducing that not from the 180 that it is this year, but from the 205 that it would be next year without this program. Because again, there are fixed costs that are going up whether or not this program is implemented. And so next year, the fee, by my math, would be at least 205. And so those families are saving about $70. They're paying 78. And then where you get to just barely saving is that they save about $10 in buying the actual bags, because again, the bag is included in that $2 fee, and a 30-gallon bag usually costs about 30 cents. And so it's true that the 30-gallon bag is roughly exactly break even, because again, that's the average. So you expect the average to be break even. Folks who are using less than the average will save money on this program, and then folks who are using more than the average will end up paying a little more.
As someone who's conceptually open to this idea, it does seem like a little bit of math games that are going to be very difficult for people to wrap their minds around. But as you said, it's not a done deal. Anasha, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about this.
Anytime. Thanks for talking to me.
Listeners can visit troyny.gov and register to speak at the meeting under the Troy City Council section of the website. The council is set to vote on the final budget proposal on Tuesday, November 24th. Catherine Rafferty speaks to Tisha Graham and Esser Patterson in our next segment about BirthNet, a Capital Region birth justice organization.
This is the Birth Justice Podcast. Today we're joined by Tisha Graham and Esser Patterson from BirthNet. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on today. So what is BirthNet, for those who don't know, and how did it get started?
Actually, the history of BirthNet is a fairly long one in the Capital Region. We are an organization, a 501c3 nonprofit organization out of Albany, New York. And we actually started back in 2001. So we are almost 20 years old, and the original focus and mission of BirthNet was to educate the public about maternity care in order to improve it. Because what we found as a group of midwives and doulas and people who were interested in just birth work in general and in maternity care issues in general, what we found was that the United States was really not as high up in the list as you might imagine of developed countries who had really good birth outcomes, maternal mortality and morbidity. Infant mortality and morbidity are the ways that we measure birth outcomes in the world. And the United States was really pretty far down on the list, like in the 20-something, below 25 on the list of developed countries. When it came to sort of birth outcomes, babies and women dying or being injured. And what we sort of decided to do as an organization was to educate folks in the capital region about ways of improving birth outcomes, as well as improving breastfeeding rates, as well as improving satisfaction around birth experience. And we did that by, doing birth fairs and panel discussions and film events. In fact, we've done many events at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. We love it over there in Troy. We talked about access to professional labor support, access to doulas, access to midwives, access to home birth, things that a lot of folks just didn't know a lot about. We do classes at the local universities and colleges, SUNY Albany in particular. 3 years ago, it became very clear to us that some of the national statistics with regard to maternal and infant mortality, particularly when it comes to birthing people in Black and Brown communities, that the rates for maternal mortality, morbidity, and infant mortality and morbidity were 3 to 6 times greater than that and those of their white or Caucasian counterparts. And so the focus of the organization back in 2017 took a very specific turn, and we made a very conscious and intentional decision to focus all of our energy and our efforts and our work into this issue, this area of birth justice, looking for ways that we can understand the gaps and looking for ways to narrow the gap between Black and Brown communities and white communities with regard to maternal and infant outcomes. So that's essentially where we are today. Our vision is to just, imagine a community where all childbearing people have access to culturally appropriate, high quality care, which results in healthy pregnancies, healthy babies, and healthy families. We are a birth justice organization who participates in the elimination of inequities in birth outcomes for all childbearing people. And we work to ensure that all birthing families have respectful and supportive maternity and infant care. How's that for a quick history? 20 minutes in about 4 minutes.
Yeah, sounds really good. Sounds like you guys are doing a lot of important work in the local area. Could you maybe tell me about some of the disparities in the capital region that you've...
We have noticed, and the Department of Health has given us some statistics that say in the Capital District, specifically in the zip code areas where people of color are primarily located, the infant and maternal mortality rates were much higher than anyone would have expected.
As I said, what we know that the national trend is that Black and Brown birthing people have a 3 to 4 times greater risk of maternal mortality than do white women. And this is regardless of their socioeconomic or their educational background. Black and Brown babies have a 5 to 6 times greater risk of infant mortality And what we realized is that, you know, these are families, you know, as Esther said, there's three zip codes in the Albany area, 3 to 5 zip codes in the Albany area, which have the highest rates of these inequities, this disparity. And yet these are families that are using the exact same clinics in some cases, certainly the exact same hospitals as their white counterparts. So they're using the same hospitals, the same practices, you know, in other parts of New York State. Disparate pay schedules or disparate pay scales for insurance companies that reimburse providers and places for birth. You have another phenomena which we refer to as sort of insurance segregation, where if you have a certain kind of insurance, you can only go to a certain place for care or to a certain place for birth. And that may be true to a certain degree with regard to prenatal care here in the Capital Region. But when it comes to birth, there aren't separate hospitals where Black and brown birthing people are going compared to white people. And the disparities are still that dramatic in the same hospitals with the same providers, because even if you're using sort of a clinic, let's say you're using the St. Peter's Clinic, for example, on South Pearl Street, once you are in labor, move into the hospital setting, obviously for your care through labor and birth, you're seeing the St. Peter's docs, the same practices. And so even in the same practices, in the same hospitals,
there is disparate care.
Yeah, there's
and this disparate outcomes. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so we come to a rather chilling and, sort of not surprising conclusion that the disparities are not based on separate hospitals or separate clinics for prenatal care, but rather the disparities are based on institutional racism. That is our conclusion. It's the conclusion not only of those of us who do this work in the Capital Region, but it's also the conclusion of folks and organizations who are involved in this issue on a national level. It is not, there's not anything else at play here in the Capital Region except for what we can describe as the ingrained institutional racism of people of color, Black and brown birthing people, being viewed differently, being treated differently, and being, in some cases, being given substandard care. And that impacts their outcomes. I mean, health disparities are power disparities. Health inequities are power inequities. And these inequities, of course, express themselves in maternity care. And that's what we're seeing here in beautiful downtown Albany, New York, the capital of New York State. We are seeing those disparities in a very, very dramatic way. And again, this is regardless of socioeconomic background and educational achievement. So that, and the way you can look at that is that a young teen mom, let's say a young white teen mom who lives in a economic marginalized community, let's say a trailer estate or trailer park, is likely to have a better outcome during her maternity care, labor, birth, and postpartum for her and her baby than is the African-American lawyer who works at the state capitol in the governor's office. So it's really a dramatic reality, and it's one that we decided as an organization we cannot and will not tolerate. So we're doing a couple of things to try to address that inequity, and that's what we're all about.
What are some ways that people could contact you or get involved with BirthNet?
BirthNewYork.org will bring you right to our website.
And that was another segment of Birth Justice, featuring interviews with birth workers and activists about childbearing and reproductive care. Next up, big question, how have families in our more challenged communities been dealing with remote learning this year? Here we listen to a principal's assessment of what's working at the schools he oversees in Albany's Arbor Hill and West Hill.
On Thursday, November 5th, the Board of Trustees for the Albany Public School District met in person and digitally, where Principal David Burnsley spoke about how schools in Arbor Hill and West Hill are reaching out to students and families in need of more than this year's remote learning.
Obviously, with the COVID, things have changed a little bit, but we understand that there are no excuses. There's no reasons not to make things happen. So we adapt to the times that we're living in. And like I said, we go out to their houses. We deliver the different paperwork that they may need for programs in our community or the state. We encourage if we need to have the parents come in. Yes, we follow all the COVID protocol and everything. But sometimes, you need that face-to-face. The social emotional supports are everything that we do. They're embedded in the curriculum. We also are working with SUNY Albany for the STEP tutors. These are students that actually will go into the classroom. They join the online classes, and they're mentors for the students and tutors. They're both. We work with SNUG. They're a wonderful organization and community partner, where we work with them to work with some of our students that might have gotten off track, and they work with them and tell them the importance of school and the importance of working with people. We try to build trust with them. We work with the Cornell Cooperative Youth CAN program, Team Bosses, where it encourages community service and entrepreneurial services. So those are some of the, a few examples of what we are doing to monitor the students and to work with the students. We understand it's the now in terms of working with them, but also when they're done with high school. And we, in terms of understanding the importance of an education, and again, trying to get the students to work not only with us, with their families, but also with the community. And the community has been wonderful in terms of the different community partners, wonderful with us, working with us. So the second phase is work. I'm working with Marcia Hines. This is her first year as our community psych coordinator. She's an amazing, amazing person. Her energy is 24 hours, 7 days a week. She will do anything and everything. We were just having a discussion yesterday about possibly trying to come up with a place off campus where we could get supports for the students who may have difficulty with technology or even having a place that's a quiet area to do work. And so we're working with some community partners right now, trying to create that, and then seeing what we could do to support the students in that. Again, we work with SUNY Albany and the Cornell Cooperative Group. Marche has reached out to the library. We have some things going on with the local libraries. One of the things I like too is that the O'Neill community site coordinator Juliana Obi and Marche Hines are combining forces. So now, even though they're two different buildings, we're getting two for one. And for example, there's a Harvest Fest coming up that Marche is throwing, and she has gotten great donations of food and other things to provide the families, because we know that some of our families are in need of food. Well, we're looking at the coat drives right now in terms of getting winter clothing for some of our families. Marche, every day Marche comes in with a different idea. It's really wonderful for me. But she's also looking at the mentoring in terms of having different women group to work with our young ladies and a men group to work with our young men. And she's looking to do different things in terms of things like athletics, even though right now with the COVID it's tough down the road. To use that to get the students involved. We have some programs that she's working on right now. We have Mediation Matters that the board were so gracious and approving for us. And that's going to allow us to teach our students the strategies of if things don't go their way or how to deal with adverse situations. and we're really excited to bring them in. So I could certainly provide more once we get that program going.
We are next going to step over to the simultaneous meeting of the Albany School District Board of Trustees, at which they discussed how area schools, especially in Arbor Hill, West Hill, and the South End, have been meeting parental and family needs for their students this year of the pandemic.
So I'm going to interject and say, number one, thank you so very much for sharing this information. It's always so good to see and hear what's happening on the instruction side of the house, because this is what we do as an educational institution, and to see what happens with our teachers and then how does it manifest itself in the lives of our students each and every day. Board members, as you can see, that despite everything else that's going on, we are still about the business of focusing on how our students are learning, how do we learn along with them, how do we change the way in which we do what we need to do to meet their needs. And
we can wait on that. I know that every school in the country is ordering Chromebooks, and I know that that's on, you know, that's been on back order, right? So I can probably ask that question later.
I know we're going to talk about, there's some more slides coming up on technology, so let's hold on that.
But for the first part, could you answer that about engagement?
So from the elementary level, for science, we have not heard that, except for having available resources, such as these STEM build bags and things like that, the challenge more from my seat is the math. And parents have been needing more support around math, and because of the way we instruct math. And so one of the sneaky things that I did in the STEM bag is I included playing cards and dice, and we incorporated them because the grant.
I wanted to just acknowledge, so one of the things you said at the very beginning about resources school by school and noticing that there was discrepancies between schools, and I wanted to really appreciate that that's one of the things that we've been growing on as a district, is that looking at things through that lens and recognizing when there's inequities between our schools. So I wanted to acknowledge and appreciate that you have done that with this to make sure that all of our schools are equitably having access to these sort of resources. And I'm just wondering, sort of related to what Damaris was asking, what Board Member Mann was asking, whether there's other ways that you've used this opportunity to look at things through the equity lens to ensure that all kids are getting access to these sorts of resources. At secondary, I know that over the years we've had sort of ups and downs in ensuring that every child feels welcomed at some of these sort of pathway classes and things like that at the secondary level. And also at the primary level, I take it that we're offering these to every classroom throughout the district, and providing the resources for our teachers' professional development as well.
I did just would like to let the board know that much of these supplies come out of the Title IV fund, the grant fund around well-rounded education and enrichment opportunities. We also sent home jump ropes for K-5 students, and every single student got a jump rope. And Ashley Chappell, our director of PE Health and Athletics, actually made certain that she bought jump ropes of different lengths so that when they got to the school, that the students got the right jump rope. So that was also funded out of that grant. That grant has really been wonderful. It's a relatively new aspect, as far as I know, for Title IV. So we were thrilled, and we were just approved for this year's fund. This came out of last year's funds largely, but this we've just been approved for this year's funds, and we'll do another batch. Ashley's working on something, and we'll get more supplies out. I think we're doing some music kits next.
This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe, and our engineer is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or would like to comment on our work, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As incredible as it may seem, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is actually produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.